Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you all here today. It's my first time coming to your new center. I've actually only been down to this Sangha once before many years ago, and I remember being at the place where you did your Sunday morning class and something had happened to the floor, so we actually sat outside under a tree. It was really quite lovely, but it was, a real thrill to pull in across the road and look at this building and see the sign on the outside that said, you know, Insight Meditation. I've taught many, many classes at different places around the Bay Area, often in churches, but they're all in someone else's church. Even if it's another Buddhist organization where James Barras does his class, it's someone else's Buddhist temple. And it was just, I really got a rush of happiness to see the name on the outside of this building. And as Stephen said, I've been involved in actually beginning a number of meditation centers and communities, and I know how much hard work it takes to do this. So I really honor and acknowledge all the work I know many of you are putting into making this happen. It really makes a difference, and I can just feel in being here and wandering around a bit and seeing the notice board and everything that's happening here, how it brings the energy together to have your own place. So it's wonderful to be here. The theme I'd like to talk about this morning and have us discuss is swimming against the tide. And it sort of goes along a bit with creating your own center and all of that that involves. For 2,500 years, the practice of Buddhism, the flourishing of Buddhism, was supported by both monastic and lay people. But they were quite separate in their roles and what they did to support the practice. It was mainly monastics who did meditation practice, who studied the teachings, gave the teachings, and kept the Buddha Dharma alive in that very direct way. And it was just the lay people's responsibility to follow the basic precepts and go and hear the teachings and support the monastics in their practice and to allow them to continue the teachings. But quite a distinct separation between their roles. Lay people were householders, lived lives, had families, jobs, businesses, and would go to the temple on Sunday or to go and hear a talk or whatever they might do, or just make offerings. The practice of generosity or merit, making merit, was one of the main things, main practices that lay people did. Well, something very different is happening here in the West as Buddhism is moving into the different countries of the West, and especially in our tradition, the Theravada tradition, with the people that brought the practice of meditation to America, Europe, Australia in the last 20, 30 years. Majority of them were lay people. There are a number of monastics, wonderful teachers, who I'm so happy they're continuing in this tradition, but directly associated with Insight Meditation and Spirit Rock Center IMS Gaia House were lay teachers who practiced in Asia very intensively. Some of them took robes, but they all disrobed either in Asia or on their return to the West, and have continued to teach and practice as lay people. And so most of us, all of us obviously here today, are lay people. So we're creating this hybrid where we're sort of halfway in between monastics who devote their lives to the practice of the Dharma, to meditation practice and the teachings, and lay people who, even though they might be Buddhists, might really value the teachings, don't practice meditation intensively. And this brings a lot of challenges to it, as I'm sure you've already experienced if you've started walking on this path of trying to bring these teachings to life, to follow them and practice them, given what is already a challenging life, that of being living here in the West as a layperson, as a householder, having a job, raising a family. Bringing these two together creates another whole set of challenges. Obviously, also some wonderful benefits, or we wouldn't do it. But this tension is what I want to talk about this morning. The other interesting thing that's happening here in the West is something that's never happened or hasn't happened for thousands of years in the Buddhist tradition, which is the mixing of traditions. Obviously, when the Buddha began teaching 2,500 years ago, there wasn't even anything called Buddhism. He just taught the Dharma, the truth, the way things are as he saw it, as he had come to understand it. Out of those original set of teachings, immediately following his death, a number of dissensions rose in the Sangha, and I think there quickly came to be about 18 or 20 different schools of Buddhism. And at one point, there was a wonderful university called Nalanda, where many of the different schools were taught and practiced together. But with the decline of Buddhism in Asia, they all dispersed. Some of the schools didn't survive. But the major schisms, which resulted in the division between Mahayana and Theravada, Theravada being the type of the background of this particular lineage, the type of Buddhism that's still practiced in Southeast Asia, Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Mahayana, which has become practiced more in China, Japan, Tibet, became quite separate, and for thousands of years had very little to do with each other, you know, geographically and in practice-wise, very separate. Here in the West, they're having connections again. And it's really very interesting to think about what might happen with that refertilization of the different schools. Is it going to get muddied? Is there going to be something new and different that will arise? Will they find that they're so different that they can't meet? Will there be you know, a hybridization that, as it happens in the animal world, where cross-fertilization can actually lead to more vigor in a species? It's a really very interesting time to be practicing Buddhism because anything could happen. It's all of these great practices and teachings coming together in, you know, the U.S., for example. It's a fairly large space, but, you know, given the perspective, it's a fairly small space, and especially given the speed of communication, the speed of travel these days. It's just, you know, with the blink of an eye, you can be somewhere else or listening to a stream talk on the internet from, you know, Lama Geshe Robsang Lapsu or something, you know, and then the next day go and hear a Chinese Chan master at somewhere else. It's just all happening here very quickly. When these kinds of processes happened, obviously, as those different schools that I spoke about earlier disseminated to different areas, mainly of Asia, you know, thousands of years ago, but the speed was very glacial. You know, it was basically people traveling on foot, and, you know, all they could do is one person speak to another and that person speak to another. That was the speed of communication. And as Buddhism came to each new country, it tended to absorb or amalgamate with the belief systems, the spiritual practices that were already there. In China, there was already Confucianism and Taoism, and Buddhism managed to move alongside. I know those streams still existed separately, but there was a way in which Buddhism merged with those beliefs and those practices, so it became integrated into society. In Tibet, the religion, I'm no expert in any of these areas, so I may be saying wrong things here, but just the general idea I hope is still true. In Tibet, it was Bon, quite a wild kind of religion from what I've heard of, with a lot of spirits and deities, and so Buddhism, as it came, incorporated those into its beliefs and its practices, and has resulted in Tibetan Buddhism today with all of the deities and the tankas and mandalas and rituals and practices that we see today. So, well, I wonder what's going to happen as Buddhism comes to the West. It's sort of hard to imagine, you know, Buddhism merging and co-opting Southern Baptist Christianity, but you never know. I mean, if you took a Sri Lankan Buddhist, a traditional Sri Lankan Buddhist, and popped him down in the middle of a Lama dance in Ladakh, in Tibetan Buddhist Ladakh, he wouldn't have a clue what was going on. I mean, they're so different. The practices are so different. So Buddhism has the capacity to absorb, still keeping the basic teachings, still keeping the basic teachings of awakening and liberation at the core, and bring in all kinds of different practices that actually can really enrich our experience. Also, obviously, what's happening here is the propensity, the tendency we have here in the West to examine everything, you know, where everything is commented on, you know, the plethora of media, avenues of media that we have from newspapers, radio, magazines, books, you know, as soon as anything new happens, Time's got a cover on it, you know, the latest trend. And, you know, you've probably seen the magazines that came out with Buddhism on the cover. You know, is this the latest thing? And putting, you know, having pictures of Spirit Rock in Time magazine or Newsweek, it's quite amazing. And, of course, all of the books that are coming out now. I just saw one advertised in Tricycle called The New Buddhism. You know, someone's already planted a flag and said, this is it. And even our own Venerable Joseph Goldstein has written a book called One Dharma, where he's talking about this blending and the confusion that he felt in hearing different teachings from people, from different Buddhist teachers that he really respected, but they were saying very different things, or so it seemed to him at the time, and really forced him to look deeper at what was essential about Buddhist practice, what was really core of these different manifestations of practice that would really resonate with him and be liberating for him. So this is the milieu that we're practicing in here in the West. It's a very rich and wonderful time, I think, to be coming to be a Buddhist. I don't know if you even consider yourselves Buddhists. It's one of the other interesting things is we can all come and practice very sincerely and not even think of ourselves as Buddhists. At Spirit Rock, where I've long been involved, we've had very heated debates as to whether to put the word Buddhism in, you know, the name of the center or the subtext of the description of the center, and people feeling very strongly one way or the other about that. I mean, it wouldn't even have been conceivable back in Tibet. You know, are we Buddhists? It's like, yes, of course. But here, everything is up for question. Everything is challenged. And the individuality that's one of the real strengths of the West, and especially of the United States, is going to bring its, is going to have an impact on how we practice and understand the Buddha Dharma. So these challenges that I'm talking about is what I want to us to discuss this morning, because as we come to understand the teachings, hear the different lists that the Buddha loved to enumerate of qualities that it's helpful to cultivate as we practice, we get sometimes a completely opposing message from the culture around us, from society, from media. And I know this is a generalization, that there are many or huge segments of the population, many individuals, who have very similar values to the ones we, I'm sure, all share. But the message that we get that gets portrayed or pushed upon us, mainly through the media, through this funneling of the tendencies of society, all unfortunately in the aim of generating income for someone or another, usually large corporations and businesses, really has an impact on how the culture evolves. I mean, we all think that we can resist these messages, that they don't affect us. But I've even seen in myself how, you know, I don't think I pay attention to ads. If I watch any television, I mute the ads. But you pick things up and images, those things, those associations that they want you to make with a product come through even if you don't think you're taking them in. So we're getting these messages all the time. Even as I drove down here, you know, just seeing one of these huge limousines beside me on the freeway, and sort of all of that represents of money and wealth and status, but also image. You know, someone thinks, oh, if I get in a limousine, it makes me a better person. You know, there's so much just in that icon of a limousine, or the billboards that say, you know, buy me, want me, need me, have me. You know, sometimes I think of them as these giant sort of eyes, you know, that are beaming out at you, you know, like those eyes on stalks that are trying to just get in your face and really impart some kind of message. It's happening all the time. But because we're lay people who've chosen to remain in society, we're not renunciates who have made that choice, that extreme sacrifice, that powerful sacrifice of putting on robes and taking vows and really limiting our ability to be influenced by these messages, by vows of poverty and celibacy, and the other very serious vows that monastics take. We're in the mix, and we have to learn how do we keep alive these values that we cherish, that we want to cultivate, given the messages that we're always getting from society. In other Buddhist countries, practicing meditation is so valued that, as I said, the lay people, even if they never sat for a moment in meditation, were always happy to give to the people that were practicing, and especially if Westerners go and practice in Asia, if any of you have had the opportunity to do that and felt the appreciation that the local people have for your effort in coming to practice, it's really very inspiring. You know, in Tibet, before the Chinese took over, I think it was something like 20% of the male population were in robes. It would just be amazing to be in a society like that. Here, it's so different. As I said, we're swimming against the tide. We're really holding up a set of values that are very different from what we get presented by the media. So practicing meditation is still somewhat of an unusual thing to do in the West. It's getting more common. I don't know how many people I meet who, when I happen to mention, after I've known them for a while, it's not something I say first up, you know, that I teach meditation, but they go, oh, I really want to meditate. I know it'd be good for me. Or the worst one is when, oh, everyone tells me I should meditate. They say it would be good. You know, they're the really hard cases when other people are telling them they should go and meditate. But it's getting more common, you know. It's not considered so weird anymore to meditate. I was recently coming back from teaching somewhere, flying, and struck up a conversation. Actually, I think I'd been on a long overnight flight. I'd coming back from Australia, I think, and so my newspaper had Air New Zealand written on it, and so the chap picked up that I'd been somewhere, and we started chatting. And it turned out he was a filmmaker, a video maker, who lived in Japan and came to the States regularly because what he did was make videos to teach Japanese people how to speak English. And he came to the States to film people speaking in the vernacular, as you could say, to film people with different kinds of accents in different kinds of situations, to give people back in Japan a sense of what it would be like to actually be in the States and speaking to people, as opposed to just learning it out of a book in the isolation of a classroom. And so he asked if I would be one of these subjects. He said, I just go around to unusual places, wherever I can find people, and I say, will you talk to me about whatever it is that interests you, your hobby, what you do, to get give, as I said, the Japanese people a sense of what it would be like to be having a conversation with someone in America. And so he was quite interested when I told him that I taught meditation and was a Buddhist, obviously, going back to Japan. And I didn't know what he was going to ask me about, so we did this at the baggage claim in San Francisco Airport. And the first thing he told me about his life, which, you know, Japan is a very fast-paced society also, a lot of pressure, very long work hours, etc. The first question he asked me was, how do you deal with stress in your life? And, you know, I knew that this would probably be relevant for his Japanese viewers, but I think he was mainly asking because he wanted to find out. And the answer I told him was, change your life. You know, you can't just put a Band-Aid on your life and say, oh, if I meditate a little bit, my life won't be as stressful. I mean, that is true. It will help. But the main thing you need to do is look at the values you have. And I can see him sort of shaking his head. He didn't want to hear that message. He wanted to know how could meditation just help him live his life as it was right now and be a little more comfortable. And that's often what people think about meditation. Oh, if I meditate, I'll feel a little better. I'll live my crazy life just as it is, but it'll make me feel a little better. And it's really not true. If you start to practice, as I'm sure you've all come to know, it shakes your life up. You really have to look at what you value, because it's challenging enough to, if your life has enough space to meditate, but if it's already full, you can't just put this on top. Something has to give a little. Unless you're willing to get up at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, and do your sitting for an hour and then take care of the kids and, you know, do the washing and go off to work or whatever. But this practice really challenges you. What do you value? Which is most important? Making a living and, you know, getting a promotion, or living a sane, healthy, and whole life? These are the kinds of things I want to talk about today. So when I thought about this, it was very easy for me to come up with a list of the kinds of things that I know are challenging. And I'll just read out a few of mine, and then I want to ask you, what are the things that you find challenging or that you value and somehow makes it difficult? I thought of things like renunciation and simplicity, patience, forbearance and tolerance, not holding on to views and opinions. It's a big one. Kindness, just being caring, gentle with other people. Sensitivity, wise speech, kind speech. Humbleness, discipline, being willing to acknowledge that there's difficulty or suffering in life. Appreciation of our elders, of the wisdom of elders and people who have more experience than we do. Peace and calm, tranquility. Being on retreat, taking time out of life, not just to go on a holiday and, you know, have all sorts of wild experiences or pleasurable experiences, but actually to step out and go on retreat. I'd stop there because I wanted to see if you had others. There are many, many, many things that as we start to practice, we come to value and we find challenging to cultivate in our lives, to make central in our lives. So please, what are the kinds of things that you either value so much that you've made a commitment to them, you've made a practice out of them, or you appreciate them, but you find it really challenging to bring them into manifestation in your life as a practitioner and as a mother, a father, a husband, a wife, a worker, a boss, a colleague. Please, and I'll write them down, and then we're going to just decide which ones we'll talk about and go from there. Yes?
Stillness.
Great. Yes.
Journaling.
Saying no at work.
Saying no. Just at work?
Well, anyway. Work's pretty extreme.
Though. Yeah, okay.
Creativity.
Clarity.
Gossip.
So some of these are the things we want and some of the things we don't want, but we can work that out. Yes.
Eating appropriately.
Sorry?
Eating appropriately.
Eating appropriately. Some of these I'll have to ask you exactly what they mean, but we'll do a vote and see which ones we want to talk about. Yes.
Service.
Okay, I'm getting along. Maybe just a couple more.
Living in the present.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sleeping enough and taking time for myself.
Mm. Okay. Yes.
Doing what you're doing, staying in the moment with it in a world that puts a lot of pressure on you.
Multitasking, yes. I had some living in the present we already had, multitasking.
I think that's a huge problem with everybody in the world.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got a long list, and we only don't have a huge amount of time. Shall I read them all again? When I read them, maybe just feel into them. Even close your eyes and do this as a sort of reflective meditation. Just to feel what these qualities, and as I said, some of them people put out were challenges, and others are qualities we want to cultivate. And just see, you know, which ones are alive for you, which ones are up, and then we can decide which ones we'll talk about. Renunciation and simplicity. patience, forbearance, and tolerance. Not holding on to views and opinions. Kindness, friendliness, sensitivity, openness, wise speech, careful speech, gentle speech, humbleness, discipline, acknowledging that there is difficulty and suffering in life, being willing to face that. Respecting and appreciating elders and wisdom of those who have more experience than us. Peace and calm. Taking time out for retreat for ourselves. Getting enough sleep. Stillness. Journaling. Saying no at work. Creativity, clarity, not gossiping, eating appropriately, doing service work, helping others, living in the present, being mindful when there's so much pressure to be multitasking, doing everything at once. Okay, it's a long list. I don't know where to start, so... Yes?
The one that's most challenging for me, I'd like you to speak about, is not holding on to fixed views. Because in our society, interacting with others, it's pretty hard to hold that stand.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start there. It's a big one. Because, you know, we're brought up in this society, even during our school days. You know, you have to speak up in class, and then they get, you know, you get into debating society or, you know, those kinds of things. Where, you know, you have to put forward an opinion. And it's not to say that these things aren't valuable or helpful. Where is it that we get into trouble with our views and opinions? Because we all have them. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying I don't. I know I do. But where is it that we get into trouble? Where is the pain and suffering? When we're attached to them. They're going to be there. I mean, if you know the basic teachings of the Buddha, when there's contact with the world in any of the six sense doors, there's an immediate vedana, the feeling tone, and out of that comes liking or not liking, preferences. Most of the time we're lost in that cycle. It's going to happen. The point is to know that what it is we're holding on to isn't the truth with a capital T. And that's where we get lost in it. It's so hard to separate what is an opinion from the truth. I mean, most of the time we think, because I'm thinking it or feeling it, it's the truth. And of course there is a truth to that, but it's a truth with a small t. There is the reality of this is my experience of the world. This is my understanding of the world, but that's very different from it being the truth. This is actually a good one to start with because for me it brings in a lot of these other qualities that I listed, or we all listed. Not holding on to views and opinions, I think, is one of the greatest renunciations that we can practice. You know, when we think of renunciation, we think of shaving our heads or, you know, taking a vow of celibacy or, you know, going off into the woods and living on roots and twigs. Giving up your views and opinions is a far greater challenge than I think any of those things I just mentioned. It's a huge practice to actually step back from that place, that line you draw in the sand and say, this is what how it should be, this is what the way things should be. Just to step back from that and to see it as a position, not the truth. And it's a really challenging area because it's not as though we want to become wishy-washy where, you know, if someone says, where do you want to go have dinner? You go, well, I don't know. Where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? You know, that little dance we all do. It's simple if someone just says, let's go have Thai food, you know, someone to just make a choice. But it's when, you know, you say Thai and they say Japanese and you both can't agree. That's where the suffering comes in. If you're willing to just go with it, to see when it's helpful to have a position and to see when it's more helpful not to. Another practice that this touches on is empathy, sensitivity, being able to put yourselves in another person's position. It's really a big one. As I said, I've been very involved at Spirit Rock. I would hate to add up the number of hours I've spent in meetings where, you know, decisions have to be made and how much time gets regurgitated around people having, you know, what aren't in the end that different opinions, but needing to stake, you know, say their piece and put the slightly different spin on something. It's, you know, that's why council process is so good, if any of you have done that. But I've always found a really helpful practice in those meetings or any kind of interaction. Even though I might find myself of a different opinion to someone as to what the best thing for Spirit Rock to do is in this small or large matter, to come down to the heart of the matter, which is people's intentions in this interaction. And that's where I guess in some way Spirit Rock is a bit of a different beast, because what I can always come down to is I know everyone has Spirit Rock and hopefully the Dharma's best intentions, best holding that in their heart, that their intention is to act for the good. Even when we're having very different ideas about how that should manifest, for me it's really helpful if I can come to that place of just letting go of what I think is right and having a sense of, well, this other person also holds these values, really cares about this place. And I know they wouldn't be doing this out of self-interest or, you know, to deliberately lead us astray. They honestly think that this is what should happen. Can I open to that? It's also helpful with views and opinions to know if what of the three character types you are. Do people know the three basic Buddhist character types? They're the same, so that they're not like a lot of these descriptive things, not highly glowing descriptions of oneself, I might say. You know, it usually... but they all have positive sides. So it's the aversive type, the greedy type, or the deluded type. You might recognize that three as the three central torments of mind, kalesas, whatever. But it's really helpful to know that, because if you tend to be an aversive type, which I can tend to be, my initial response to any new idea is, no, it's a bad idea. You know, that's not good. And just to know that helps me, again, step back a bit from holding on to, oh, this shouldn't be this way, you know, because I don't like it. If I can just, oh, that's just my aversive tendency, can I just take a breath and open to what this person might be suggesting and see if there's value in it, rather than just holding on to that initial response, that knee-jerk kind of response of, I don't like this. So seeing as, what's your name?
Diane.
Do you want to talk a little about what your an example of a challenge or how you've worked with it?
I feel surrounded by people who have very strong
beliefs. Oh, I see.
And I don't. I do not have to do with people I have. And so I'm confronted by people who are very strong in their beliefs. And I feel wishy-washy. And I also feel very little like I want to advocate my way. So that's a challenge for me.
That's true. As I said, this... To let go of views and opinions doesn't mean we shouldn't have any. If you read the Buddha's teachings, he was always saying, you know, it's like this, and, you know, you stupid person, what are you saying that for? You know, he was very strong sometimes in his talking to people he thought were of wrong opinion, you know, wrong view. But it is a challenging one. But that's where I think this sort of reflection on what do we value, to make a list like the one we went through here today and really see, oh, this is what I value. I'm not going to back away from this, whatever, you know, it is. And it's a, you know, we came up with a lot just today. It's really helpful just to choose one or two or, you know, whatever number works for you and make a commitment to cultivating them in your life. Someone mentioned journaling, doing something like journaling about what do I really value? What's the sort of bottom line for me? And then it transcends views and opinions. It does, you know, for me, a view and opinion is something that's put on top of what my basic values are. You know, it's maybe an expression of them. It can be an expression of them. But it's not, you know, I wouldn't consider any of these things that I listed. You know, I don't have an opinion that wise speech is a good idea. It's a truth for me. So, I start off by saying capital T or small t. I think it can vary between that, but something that you take to, in your heart of hearts to be valuable, you have to really make a commitment. This is where the challenge comes in. As I said, this is not easy. So we need to really reflect on what is it that this practice is leading me towards? Where is it challenging? You know, where are the places where I've sort of kept a little in the dark or in the background? You know, I can just leave that part of my life pretty much the same, because in this part I'm doing so well. You know, I'm really focusing on my daily meditation practice and coming on Sunday morning. So this part where, you know, I gossip at work, I just sort of slip over that. It all has to become integrated eventually, and that's a challenge where everything has to be brought into the light of day. You know, this practice is really like those giant Hollywood spotlights that shine. I was down in LA recently, and I was sort of going, oh, look, and people are going, oh, they're all the time, you know, just everywhere, these spotlights. But it's such an analogy of, you know, what this is what this practice is like. It turns this searing light onto all parts of your life, your belief systems, who you take yourself to be, how you live your lives, what you value. And of course, you know, at times it's just got a narrow beam and it's only shining on one part of your life, and that's all you can cultivate. We can't do everything at once. But eventually, at some point, everything has to become integrated, nothing left out. So we've only really discussed one, and not in very much depth, and we only have about 5 minutes left. Maybe I should just do my wrapping up of this, because I realized it was going to be a lot, but I was just interested to see what came out for you as a challenge. And this was a good one, because, as I said, it touches a number of the areas that we named in the beginning. I guess what I really wanted to do in bringing this topic up this morning is, you know, I know it's not a new one, you're all aware of these challenges, is just to encourage you to get very specific about them. I find it a really helpful practice. It's one of the reasons why I like to, you know, write these kind of talks or think about these kind of things, is I get to write them down. I get to think about, what are these areas in my life do I need to bring more attention to, or that I value so much I need to make a commitment? You know, like wise speech. We had a class a couple of weeks ago where the theme was wise speech, and I said, asked everyone, is there anyone here for whom this is not a challenge? Or I forget which way I put it. Who's still working with this? For whom this is not a challenge, that's the way I put it. And, you know, looked around the room, and one person put their hand up, and we all went. And we sort of felt a bit, but I think that's true. For most of us, it's a huge challenge to work with wise speech. But as the class went on, he again raised his hand and said, I really have to qualify this. It's not that I'm perfect in this. He said, I've just made such a commitment to it because I had the experience where I was talking about someone to someone else, and I turned around and the person I was talking about was right behind me. And it was so painful that I just vowed then and there to make this a real practice for me. So that's all he meant when he put his hand up. It wasn't that, you know, he was giving himself an A in wise speech. He just said, I have made such a commitment to this that it's a central part of my practice. So this is what I'm encouraging you to do. I really find reflective meditations very helpful, where I sit with my pad and pen in my morning meditation and I have a theme. And I write, just as it comes to me, what's up, out of a meditative space. So it's not journaling, it's not sitting there writing. I do my meditation, the theme is there, and an idea or a thought will come, and I'll write it down, and then I'll come back to my meditation. I find it a really helpful way of engaging with a topic. And so to come up with a list of 3 or 4 or 5 of these kinds of areas that are challenging or that you value, and really see, how could I make a practice of this? How could I make a practice of bringing more peace into my life, or more calm, or resisting the pressure to multitask? How could I have my work complete my work in a timely fashion without feeling this sense of chaos in the work or this pressure to be doing a million things at once. None of these have easy answers. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about them as challenges. And it's only by bringing them up, making them alive for us, talking about them with our Dharma friends, our Dharma buddies. What do you do about this? How do you work with this? How do you make your workplace a little more calm and not so hectic? That we actually can begin to make our practice our life and our life our practice. As lay people, this is what we have to do. If we just, you know, keep the meditation practice or the practice of freedom only alive when we formally sit, it's a very small part of our day. Or the week a year, if we're lucky, we get to go on retreat. It's a very small part of our lives. We need to incorporate all of these things as practices, not just good ideas. You may have found out that's not enough. You know, oh, it would be a good idea if I meditated. It really has to bring in a lot of discipline. One of the other things I said that are challenging, you know, if any of you have struggled with keeping up a daily sitting practice, or if you've made a commitment to say not gossiping, really takes discipline to, you know, have that flag go on when you find yourself tending in that direction or other people are, you know, starting to do that. How to back away graciously without, you know, criticizing them for their involvement in that. So the point of this is not to separate ourselves from society. We've made this choice of being lay people, of living in society. We have to honor that, you know, to raise our families, to have our relationships, to work and to love and to share with friends, to do all those kinds of things. But it's to strengthen and nourish and affirm those things we do value that are challenged, that are difficult to keep up, to keep alive in our busy lives. And just like starting this center here and putting the name, you know, this is sort of what I'm saying, we're naming it. Putting that name out, everyone that drives by sees it. I get such a kick out of that, it's great. I don't know, you know, if you had just people walking off the street and say, what's this place? Yeah, you know, it's like that mind game, you know, that you get with Windows where if you click on one thing and the ripple effect goes out. Unfortunately, if you click on the wrong thing, the whole thing explodes, but hopefully that won't happen here. It really has an effect. If you make these commitments, this center is a sign of a commitment to lay practice. All of these things we talked about this morning are ways that practice manifests. Ways we can strengthen that practice, that we have to. These are not sort of things, suggestions, oh, this might be nice to do. This is like essential. This is what our practice is. This is what our practice must become. And then what happens is we're not so much swimming against the tide. What happens then is we enter the stream. That stream of practice, that stream of life, that goes in one direction only. I don't know, you know, if you know anything about Buddhism, the first stage of enlightenment is called Sotapanna, stream entry. And I, you know, some people think, oh, first stage of enlightenment, it's some big special experience one has to happen to become a stream enterer. Well, I recently finished, I've been reading it for ages and all sorts of other books intervened, but I recently finished that wonderful book, The Life of the Buddha, that describes the Buddha's life all from the suttas, taken from the Pali Canon. And there's this wonderful story where he goes to, you know, he's always traveling around. He goes to this new town. And Ananda, his faithful companion, says, oh, noble one, dear Lord, last time we came to Vasali, since we were last in Vasali, so-and-so has died, and so-and-so has died, and so-and-so has died, and the lay woman so-and-so has died, and the layman so-and-so has died, and the monk so-and-so, and the nun so-and-so. What's happened to them? You know, because he believes in afterlives. Where have they ended up? And the Buddha goes through this list that Ananda named. So-and-so is in this realm, heaven realm, and so-and-so. The lay men and women became stream enterers or non-returners. They, you know, were on the path of enlightenment, so not a big distinction between monastics and lay people at that time. becoming enlightened, though a lot of them, I think, had that good fortune of becoming enlightened hearing a Dharma talk. For us, it doesn't seem so easy these days, so if it happens to any of you this morning, I'd be very happy to hear about it. No expectations, of course. But then the Buddha said, but enough, Ananda. If every time we go to a new place, you ask me what's happened to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, this will be very wearisome for me. So I'll tell you how you can tell someone's destination. And he said, oh, and how you can tell for yourself. He said, if you have faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and you lead a virtuous life, you're a stream enterer. You've entered the stream. You're a stream winner. And I thought that was wonderful. There was no description of amazing meditative experiences, no, you know, having to go and radically change anything or, you know, even become a monk or a nun or a renunciate. Faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the Buddha that I'm presuming you all know this because Gil is a wonderful teacher and I'm sure he's taught you, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and leading a virtuous life. So we all here have entered the stream. And in entering the stream, as each one of us enters, the stream gets a little stronger because we carry each other along in this path. Creating this center and coming here and practicing together supports each other. I'm sure you feel that. And each one of us makes that commitment and shows the other the way. When someone else gets a little tired or a little unsure, there's someone else there to help, to assist. So we're all doing it together, and it's wonderful. So, 10:48, it's time for potluck. So just to end with a short dedication of merit. May all the good intention, the good works, the good practice, the sincerity of heart that has brought us here today, all our acts of kindness and generosity, the merit that we've accumulated in following the Buddha's way and being committed to cultivating a heart that's open and kind, and the wisdom and equanimity that allow us to live life fully and wisely, may the merit of all that not be kept just for the benefit of ourselves, but offered wholeheartedly, completely, without hesitation, to the benefit of all beings everywhere, all beings in all states, in all forms, without exception. May all beings everywhere be safe, be peaceful, and be liberated. So thank you.